And welcome to this month's Drinking on the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Bill Howell, here on KDLL 91.9 FM Kenai Soldotna, listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula. As always, thanks to Recess Duty for playing us in with our theme song. Let's get started, as always, with beer news. On April 16th, the Brewers Association released its annual Craft Brewing Industry Production Report. The number of operating craft breweries in the United States continued to climb in 2023, reaching an all-time high of 9,761, including 2,092 microbreweries, 3,502 brewpubs, 3,910 taproom breweries, and 257 regional craft breweries. The total U.S. operating brewery count was 9,906, up from 9,824 in 2022. Throughout the year, there were 495 new brewery openings and 418 closings. Openings decreased for a second consecutive year, with the trend reflecting a more mature market. The closing rate increased in 2023, but continued to remain relatively low at approximately 4%. Driven by the growing number of breweries and a continued shift in hospitality-focused business models, craft brewers directly employed 191,421 people in 2023, a 1.1% increase from 2022. Collectively, small and independent brewers produced 23.4 million barrels of beer in 2023, a decline of 1% from 2022, though craft's overall beer market share by volume grew to 13.3%, up from 13.1% in 2022, as craft's declines were smaller than overall beer volume losses. On April 5, 2024, Visit Anchorage hosted the 2024 Seymour Awards. With dozens of outstanding businesses around town being recognized, 49th State Brewing was recognized as the Member of the Year in the Business of Any Size category. Tickets are now on sale for the Gourmet Brewers Dinner, which will take place on May 24th in collaboration with the Southeast Alaska State Fair and Beer Fest in Haines. Chef Travis Kukul of Malo Nista Catering will produce the dinner for the sixth time. The banquet is the culmination of 12 months of gathering, foraging, fermenting, growing, and curating local foods for an unforgettable night of hyper-local dining. The dinner features five beer-inspired courses plus appetizers. Each course includes two brewer-chosen pours of exclusive beer pairings that won't be available during the festival. Tickets are only $100 per seat. Attendance at Beer Fest is not required to attend the dinner. This event always sells out, so if you'd like to attend, get your tickets now. Seward Brewing Company will open its doors for the 2024 season on Wednesday, May 1st. Girdwood Brewing Company will hold its first ever live music event, Girdwood Grooves, on Saturday, May 4th. There will be three bands at this inaugural event: Raised by Elephants from 2:30 to 4, Zen Trembles from 4:30 to 6, and Black Barrel and the Bad Men from 6:30 to 8. There will be a limited number of Girdwood Grooves t-shirts and stickers on sale at the event. The music will be outdoors, so dress accordingly and hope for sunshine. Tickets are $15 and $10 for under 21 if supervised by a legal guardian. The brewery will be open to the public from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m., and after that, it will be by ticket only. No dogs. There will be three food trucks on site, Blue Ristra, Mountain Pies, and the Hungry Deckhand. Please, no outside food or beverages. Parking will be limited, so carpool, walk, bike, or take Girdwood's free shuttle. Please do not park on the Alyeska Highway. That's it for this month's beer news. Up next, we'll have the owners of Girdwood Brewing. This is Drinking on the Last Frontier, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna.
The annual electronics recycling event is 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Saturday, April 27th at the Central Peninsula Landfill in Soldotna in partnership with Cook Inlet Keeper and Regroup. Electronics recycling helps protect water quality and healthy fisheries. For acceptable items, fees, and scheduling a drop-off time for businesses and nonprofits, call 907-252-2773 or email regroupkenaipeninsula@gmail.com.
We've got brothers Rory and Brett Marenko, the owners of Girdwood Brewing Company. How are you guys doing today?
Awesome, man. Got a beautiful sunny day in Girdwood.
Yeah, it's pretty nice here in the Kenai. About time we were getting some good weather. How about your Girdwood Grooves that's coming up here in like a week or so on Saturday, May 4th? Let's talk about that.
Yeah, man, we're super excited. As you know, as of January 1st this year, we're now allowed 4 live musical events per year. So this is our first foray into that. We're going pretty big. We're going to have 3 bands over the course of the day with 1.5-hour sets each. So hoping to bring in maybe a little different crowd with each one and just keep the music jamming.
Sounds great. So this is your first one. You've got 3 more left this year. Have you got ideas about when you're going to be doing them?
Oh, we're gonna see how this first one goes. But it's taken quite a bit more time and effort into the planning process than we kind of anticipated. So see how this one goes. Make sure, you know, there's no glitches or anything that goes wrong, and make sure it's well received in the community. And then we'll kind of go from there. But really, you know, once we hit June, July, August, we're pretty slammed with tourist season. So we don't necessarily even have time to host a live event then. So maybe we're thinking shoulder season. So maybe here in the springtime and then maybe into the fall in like September or something.
Yeah, I'd say we put the same effort towards this that we put towards anything we do at Girdwood Brewing. So we want to make sure it's, you know, a polished event.
Yeah, no.
We put a lot of effort into it, contacting just, you know, various members of our community, taking input from people. We hired a sound engineer that's putting all that sound and stuff together. So I think it's going to be a hit. We're hoping for some sunny weather like this. It's an outside venue. But yeah, I think it's going to be a good time.
Are you guys got any kind of like upper bound on how many people you're going to accommodate? I mean, do people need to worry about tickets selling out? How are you handling that?
You sold a little over 100 tickets to date. Right now we're capping it at 450 people. Okay. So we'll see. I imagine we'll sell quite a few tickets on the day of, you know, depending on what Mother Nature provides for us. So,
that sounds good. So this is as you mentioned, this is your first chance to implement the new rules that went into effect on the 1st of January. Are you planning to take advantage of anything else? I mean, I assume you guys are adjust your hours so you can stay open till 9. Anything else that is part of the new rules that you guys are planning to avail yourselves of?
Yeah, we took advantage of the 9 o'clock right away. As you know, I think we were hoping for 10, but we got 9. So that was one of the things we jumped on right away. With our business structure being in the ski town here, it made complete sense, especially during the winter when like night skiing goes till 8. We still had another hour where people could come stop by. We're going to extend that into the summer. And then we're doing 11 o'clock opening in the summer too, just to broaden our hours, bring in the lunch crowd.
As long as we're talking about live events, could I get your opinion on the court case that's going on? Are you familiar with the one I'm talking about?
Yeah, there's a few breweries in Alaska that are suing, saying that it's unconstitutional to prohibit live entertainment in breweries.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I haven't heard any, if it's had any traction or anything, but I have not heard any traction one way or the other on that. So
Yeah, I don't think they've had any arguments or anything yet, just that that's been filed. I haven't heard any details, but I assume you guys are hoping for a favorable outcome for the breweries, huh?
Oh, yeah, most definitely. I mean, you've probably seen some of the infographics that we've published.
Yes.
That just show how restrictive and really kind of behind the curve Alaska brewery laws are compared to the rest of the United States.
I know what you mean. We're definitely on the low side of the spectrum as far as what we'll let breweries do and stuff like that. It's pretty bad. Enough about that. Let's talk beer, man. You guys got any interesting new releases coming out or out?
Yeah, some of our more favorite ones recently, we're out of it on draft, but we still have cans. We did a Westline West Coast Pilsner. That was our 7th anniversary beer. That one's tasting delicious and has actually been one of our more popular Pilsners, or probably our most popular Pilsner we've made. So still have cans of that we pour for onsite or people can get to go. Coming up, or actually still on tap, on draft, standing cans. So we have our Collective Perspective Volume 6. That's our collab we do with Devil's Club from Juneau and Black Spruce from Fairbanks. Those guys came out here earlier this spring. We shredded some pow and then we brewed that beer. And that one's also tasting super good, just kind of a light, pretty crushable IPA, but weighs in at like 7%, so it still packs a punch, but just nice and crisp, easy drinker. And then I guess on that similar train, we have we brewed a Helles for an event coming up here in Sunday, May 19th. It's a collaboration with the Wildlife Conservation Center down here, and that's called Hold My Bear. has some awesome artwork by a local artist, so looking forward to releasing that one. That should be a great summer easy drinker.
Yeah, like you say, you guys must be ramping up, trying to get ahead of the game with production for when you get super busy during the summer, I would assume.
Yeah, as much as we can. We're always limited by cold storage, but we're full right now, so hopefully that keeps us going into the summer.
We've got the end of the season with the Alyeska Ski Resort, the Spring Carnival, so Slush Cup, their big celebration coming up this weekend. So that Saturday will be one of our busier days here of the spring, if not the year. And then, like you're saying, the next weekend we have our live music, Girdwood Grooves, going on. So we're looking to really ramp it up and get people excited for summer here.
Sounds good. I don't remember. Are you guys planning to hit Haynes Fest on Memorial Day weekend?
Not at the moment. We didn't plan ahead for that, so we'll have to see if there's still any slots available.
Okay. So you mentioned that you're limited by your cold space. Have you guys got any plans for the future to look at expansion in any way?
No, if anything, maybe just take over a little bit or the remaining quarter of our building. But it's a cold room or cold storage, I feel like, as a brewery, is always that battle of, you know, how much do I need now? You can always use a little more probably, but it's, you know, a lot of space that sometimes is empty. So it's a tough one. I think we're pretty well versed, you know. No expansion plans though this time.
Okay. No space or hardware that you've got your eye on?
No, we're pretty full in our current brewery state, which suits our, you know, our current tap room model suits us well. But I think we're feeling good where we're at, just especially with the current state of beer. It's definitely not quite in a decline, but the growth has slowed dramatically since we initially opened way back in 2017. So we're feeling good where we're at just with our taproom space. And I think if anything, we're just trying to like use these, you know, live events and draw more people to our space. You know, we have the best control over how our product is presented here. And we like it that way. So
yeah. And you get to capture the greatest part of the retail margin.
Oh yeah, definitely.
So looking further ahead, you guys got anything? You got anything special you're going to work on? You got any more collaborations in the offing? Planning to do any barrel age stuff? Anything people should keep their eye out for?
We have a double barrel age stout that we're doing, kind of a collab coming with Anchorage Distilling. We've had one of their barrels, and we put essentially the same beer as Girdwood Reserve, our annual release. We put that in one of their whiskey barrels, and then we transferred it. They gave us another barrel. We transferred it to that one and then gave the initial one back to them, and they're now aging some whiskey in it. So kind of like the back and forth thing. We'll see where that goes.
Well, that should be very interesting. Are you planning to can it when you're done, bottle it? It's just going to be on draft. How is it going to be packaged?
It's only one barrel, so that'll probably just be a draft only.
And you guys are still doing your rotating food trucks, right?
Yeah, we do. As of Memorial Day weekend, so kind of the start of where summer really starts to kick off for us, and all the way through Labor Day weekend in the beginning of September. So end of May through beginning of September, we're going to have two food trucks on site every day, and we'll be open 11 to 9, so have plenty of lunch options or late night food for people.
People need to know that, so if they're like me and they're driving by and they need to stop for lunch, they know they got an option there.
Yeah, and there's more food trucks to choose from than ever now, so tune into our either social media feed. We publish pretty much weekly what the food trucks are, or if you go to our website, we have an up-to-date calendar there.
And as far as finding your stuff, pretty much it's at the brewery, right? For anybody that's looking to buy it, that's where they should go.
Yeah, we do a couple can drops a year to La Bodega. That tends to just be in the fall. That's kind of when our capacity allows us to sell stuff besides just on site. So probably we'll be the same thing this year. Maybe sometime late September through December, we'll do a couple can drops. But other than that, just at the brewery.
Okay. Have I seen you guys on at Tent City?
Draft-wise, we do. We reach out a little bit. Palmer Ale House always has cryo on tap. Kinley's in Anchorage has Funkberry Pie and cryo. And those are kind of our main accounts. And then we do have some one-offs here and there, like Tent City, Serrano's, South. Those are less consistent. Yeah, so that's we're draft. So we branch out a little more. Whiskey Ramen, actually, they have cryo on tap as well.
People know that's where they can look for it, find your stuff. So, well, hey, guys, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. Really appreciate it. And hope you have a great Girdwood Grooves on May 4th and a wonderful summer. Fingers crossed for better weather than we had last year.
Only one way to go but up.
Yeah, that's true. All righty. Well, thanks a lot. This is Drinking on the Last Frontier, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. We'll be right back with our next segment.
The Kenai Watershed Forum's Kenai River Fair is 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. Saturday, June 8th at Soldotna Creek Park. Fun educational activities for all ages, free food, and raffle prizes. Admission is free. For more information, to apply for an education booth, or to volunteer, visit kenaiwatershed.org.
Following up on my feature last month about the early history of alcohol in Alaska, I thought this might be a good time to talk about the fabled brewing heritage of the historic town of Skagway. The first Stampeders arrived in Skagway less than 2 weeks after the SS Portland had docked in Seattle with news of the gold strike. On July 29, 1897, when the mail steamer Queen landed these first anxious would-be millionaires on the beach, Skagway was barely a collection of tents. By the first half of 1898, when Skagway was teeming with Stampeders, it was the biggest town in Alaska. In these wild early days, Skagway was under the control of the notorious con man and crime boss, Jefferson Randolph Soapy Smith. In her biography of Smith, King Con, Jane G. Haig describes the state of the town. Skagway itself was chaos. Only one dock had been completed so far, and most of the gold seekers and their tons of goods were dumped on the beach. If they could not pack them quickly to higher ground, the inexorable high tides would soon swamp them, ruining sacks of sugar and flour, bacon and beans, and perishable supplies beyond redemption. Beyond the beach, the main street, optimistically named Broadway, was a sea of mud. The businesses lining each side were chiefly saloons and crude hotels still housed in tents. Billy Moore's sawmill could not keep up with the demand for lumber. And now, hordes of gold seekers were disembarking every day. Heavy snow falling on the summit of White Pass was threatening to close the trail, making all the new arrivals Soapy's unwilling but welcome hostages for the winter. Here was an obvious market for alcohol in all its forms, including beer. If an excuse was needed, there were many to choose from, starting with the absence of sewers and the lack of safe drinking water in Skagway. In addition, it was common knowledge that drinking beer helped prevent scurvy, one of the most common medical threats in the North Country. A large amount of beer was sent north by brewers such as Rainier Brewing of Seattle and the American Brewing Company of St. Louis, Missouri, whose ABC beer was well known in Skagway. Since beer is 90% water, and water is the one ingredient for beer that Alaska possesses in abundance, imports, like Rainier, would always be more expensive than locally produced brews. Ads from the time show Rainier selling for 12.5 cents compared to 10 cents for locally produced beer. This price differential shows why local breweries were so quick to open in boom towns such as Dyea and Skagway. To meet this demand, three breweries opened in Skagway within 3 years. Robert Smith and William Matlock founded the Skagway Brewing Company in 1897, hiring Herman Barthel to be their brewmaster. Barthel was a highly respected and experienced brewmaster from San Francisco. Hiring such a well-qualified individual signaled the partner's commitment to making a quality product that could compete with the imports from Seattle and elsewhere. Barthel arrived in Skagway in 1898. He was a naturalized U.S. citizen, having emigrated from Germany in 1880, and was accompanied by his wife and two sons. Shortly after his arrival, the Skagway News began to contain ads for beer from the Skagway Brewing Company, featuring a seated male figure in a tuxedo. A rival newspaper, the Daily Alaskan, also contained ads for Skagway Brewing. Theirs featured a wrestling bull and lion. Both ads mentioned the brewery's Red Star beer, possibly inspired by the famous Red Triangle of Bass Ale, one of the world's first registered trademarks, and solicited family trade, which referred to beer being purchased for later consumption at home. Clearly, the Skagway Brewing Company was now a going concern. Given that it was built from scratch, it's not surprised that in 1899, the Skagway Brewery was considered to be one of the best equipped and thoroughly modern breweries on the Pacific Coast. Its annual capacity was 30,000 barrels after an approximately $25,000 investment by Smith and Matlock. That would be about $500,000 in today's dollars. Writings at the time described the building housing the brewery as being 4 stories tall with walls that were 14 inches thick and an exterior covered in corrugated iron. The engine and brew room measured 30 feet by 30 feet and contained a 30-horsepower steam engine that powered the brewery's equipment. Hot and cold running water was piped throughout the building, and the entire structure was heated by steam to maintain the proper brewing temperature through the long Alaskan winter. The mass tun was sized to accommodate 30-barrel batches, and the fermentation cellar had a capacity of 800 barrels. There was also a large bottling works as well, housed in a separate building. As large and modern as Skagway Brewing Company was, it still faced competition almost from the start. Charles A. Sake arrived in Skagway in December 1897, accompanied by his wife and two children. Almost immediately, he purchased land for a brewery between 6th and 7th Avenues and placed ads in the local papers announcing his intention to open the city brewery. He then returned to Seattle to purchase the equipment required for the new venture. Sake was an experienced brewer, having worked for the Northern Pacific Brewing Company, and announced that he intended the city brewery to produce both lager and steam beer. By the middle of 1900, the city brewery was well established and providing stiff competition to the Skagway Brewing Company. An article in the Daily Alaskan from July of that year describes a visit to Sake's Brewery in glowing terms. The city brewery covered nearly 10,000 square feet and 2 stories, and every inch was devoted to making beer. Apparently, Sake's brewing was a very artisanal process, with him being directly involved in almost every step. The paper reported that the brewery had excellent cold storage rooms, which were kept cool using natural ice, and that City Brewery placed great emphasis on utilizing a proper lagering process. Sake was quoted as reiterating his commitment to Skagway and to making excellent quality steam and lager beers. It was certainly no coincidence in the same month that their rival was receiving such a glowing review. Smith and Matlock of Skagway Brewing held an open house and invited the public to come and sample their pure sparkling lager beer. This beer was described as clear, amber in color, with the most delightful sharp taste, perfect beer. Smith was quoted describing the quality of his product and crediting the sophistication of his brewery, stating, "Our plant is perfect." He also bragged about the purity of the brewing water, pumped pure and cold from a depth of 15 feet. As if two excellent breweries going head-to-head for the beer trade in Skagway were not enough, for a short period of time, there was a third brewery in the mix. The Gambrinus Brewery, opened by Franz Gassenider in 1898. It was located on 7th Avenue between Main and State Streets in the same block as the City Brewery and also included a bottling plant. Unfortunately, the market in Skagway could not support three large, well-equipped breweries, and the Gambrinus Brewery was the first to falter, going out of business by the fall of 1899. It should be noted that the establishment of each of these breweries, as well as the saloons they sold their product to, was technically illegal under the territorial law governing Alaska at the time. In 1898, Alaska was still considered Indian country, with the production of alcohol being forbidden by the Customs Act of 1868. However, with stampeders flooding into the territory, it was clear to everyone that a change was needed. In 1899, President William McKinley signed a bill into law that legalized saloons and established an annual $1,500 fee, equivalent to over $35,000 in modern money, for a license to operate, with the funds being used to support public education. Citizens of Skagway voted to accept this type of licensing scheme as opposed to the alternative, which was to require saloons to submit general petitions to a majority of the white adult male and female persons living within a 2-mile radius. It had taken over 30 years, but it was at last no longer against the law to produce, sell, or consume alcohol in Alaska. So what were the beers produced by the Skagway breweries and sold in the town saloons like? We know from their advertisements that the breweries produced both lager and steam beers. Many of the brewers were immigrants from Germany, where lagers were the dominant beer style, so it's not surprising that they were extremely familiar with producing these beers. Lager beers, of which Pilsners are the best-known example, are produced using a strain of yeast that works best at low temperatures, typically just a few degrees above freezing. However, the yeast works slowly, meaning the beer must be stored, lager in German for to store, for several weeks at these low temperatures. The end result of this process is a clean-tasting, refreshing brew with a nice malt flavor and crisp hop bitterness. Given the primitive conditions that existed on the rough-and-tumble western frontier, it was often difficult to achieve the sustained low-temperature storage needed for a proper lager. During the early days of the California Gold Rush in the mid-19th century, brewers in San Francisco were forced to improvise a way to use lager yeast at higher temperatures than normal. The result of their efforts was what came to be known as steam beer, though exactly why it was given that name remains a matter of debate. Steam beer was, and still is, brewed using a lager yeast, but at much higher than normal lager temperatures, resulting in beer that has some of the flavor characteristics of an ale. As many of the brewers who came to Alaska did so by way of stints at breweries on the West Coast, it's not surprising that they would have become familiar with this uniquely American style of beer. Since many of the miners now flocking to the new boom towns in Alaska also came from that same region, it's again hardly surprising that there was a strong demand for beers made in the style to which they had become accustomed back home. Besides the staples of lager and steam beers, there's also evidence that other beer styles were brewed in Alaska during this period. Porters and stouts were advertised and seemed to have been quite popular, as well as other British styles, such as imitators of the famous Bass Ale. Even with the end of the stampede in 1898, workers continued to flood into Skagway to work on the construction of the White Pass and Yukon Route Railroad. Despite the expense of the annual license fee from 1899, it appears the saloon numbers in Skagway remained at relatively high levels until the completion of the route on July 29, 1900. Then the bottom fell out of the saloon business in Skagway. As the saloons fell on hard times, so did the breweries that supplied them. During 1900 to 1901, business became very competitive between the breweries and local saloons, thanks to the decreasing single male population of Skagway. Skagway's economy was no longer growing, and it was becoming increasingly clear that it was not going to become a northern metropolis. The beer market was shrinking, and the sale of import beers such as Rainier at local saloons provided strong competition to local breweries. By the end of 1901, there had been a serious shakeup in the brewing business in Skagway. The city brewery ceased operation. Charles Sake remained in Skagway but changed his profession from brewer to saloon keeper. Robert Smith and William Matlock sold the Skagway Brewing Company to its brewmaster, Herman Barthel. The 1902 business license for the brewery lists him as the sole owner. Smith and Matlock left Skagway to pursue other business interests around the territory, though they both retained properties in the town. By the fall of 1902, Skagway had only 7 saloons still operating. The high license fee and decreasing population were draining resources faster than the saloon keepers could bring in customers. Skagway's saloon owners instituted a custom that had long been practiced in the rest of the country, but had not been necessary during the gold rush days, the free lunch. Starting in October, as the summer transients left town, all of the saloons engaged in a bitter warfare to see who could offer the swankiest free meal while keeping their prices high. It was another sign that the saloon business in Skagway was becoming increasingly cutthroat and did not bode well for the future. Herman Barthel did his best to maintain the Skagway Brewing Company as a going concern, but the combination of economics and the moralists of the Women's Christian Temperance Union was eventually too much for him. The Skagway Brewing Company closed its doors in 1905. In June 1906, William Matlock, one of the founders of the Skagway Brewing Company, attempted to resurrect brewing in Skagway by providing funding to William Schwarzenberg, another German-born brewer who came to the United States in 1891. In August, Schwarzenberg began advertising his new business, the Eagle Brewery. It's unclear exactly how long the brewery operated. Some sources indicated it was in business until 1910, but no advertisements appear in the local papers after October 1906. It was certainly defunct by 1913, when Matlock filed a civil action against Schwarzenberg to recover the money owed to him, since by then Schwarzenberg was residing outside of Skagway at the Perseverance Mine in Juneau. So ends the story of brewing in Skagway for the next 9 decades. Then the famous name of the Skagway Brewing Company was resurrected in a brew pub located in Golden North Hotel. It lasted from 1997 until 2002. In 2007, Michael Healy, a South Dakota native and longtime Skagway resident, spotted an opportunity and bought the derelict brewery's equipment. He moved the brewery to a brand new building located at 7th and Broad, not far from where the original Skagway Brewing Company was located in 1898. On July 4, 2007, the Skagway Brewing Company again fired up the brew tanks and opened its doors, welcoming both locals and thousands of tourists from the huge cruise ships that visit Skagway daily during the summer. Since then, the brewery has undergone an expansion and relocation, but remains one of the foundational businesses in Skagway. Herman Barthel would be proud. Coming up next, we'll have an interview with Jake Walgenbach, the owner and brewer at Naptown Brewing in Sterling. This is Drinking on the Last Frontier, KDL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna.
The Kenai Arts Center has Visual Feast, the 33rd annual KPBSD Juried Student Art Show, on display through April 26th. With work from middle and high school students in the Kenai Peninsula Borough School District. The center is at 810 Cook Avenue in Old Town Kenai, open noon to 5 p.m. Wednesday through Saturday. More information at kenaiartcenter.org or Kenai Art Center on Facebook.
Hello and welcome back to Drinking on the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Bill Howell, here on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. Up next, we've got an interview with Jake Walgenbach, the owner and brewer at Naptown Brewing in Sterling. Jake, how are you doing today, sir?
Doing well, Bill. How are you doing?
Doing well. Thank you for taking the time to talk with us. How are things going at Naptown?
Man, they're going pretty good. We're seeing the summer uptick kind of early. And we're just kind of preparing for that. But, yeah, business has been good. We just hit our one-year anniversary a couple months ago.
Right. You tag-teamed that on for St. Patty's Day, right?
Yeah, kind of by design.
I know you guys, you've got your full beverage dispensary license, so you had bands and everything there for that. So was it well attended? I'm sorry I couldn't make it. I had to work that day.
Yeah, it actually was. It was standing room only. We had Dane Williams and Eric Doucette playing indoors. We didn't do it outdoors this time, but we're getting prepped for more outdoor music to come this summer. We're working on a stage, but as far as the party went, it was a great turnout. We were completely plugged off in our parking lot here, so it was a good time.
Well, great. Yeah, I actually came by there on Sunday and had a glass of the Myrmidon, which I thought was quite excellent.
Oh, well, thank you. Yes. Yeah, it's one of my favorites.
I know you're taking a break from brewing right now to talk with us, so what are you brewing?
So right now we're doing a brand new pale ale using a French hop, newer hop. Well, in the brewing world, the 2019 is considered a pretty fairly new hop called Mistral, doing the single hop for that. So being another pale ale similar to the Myrmidon, but with a single hop, we'll see how we like it.
Obviously, you're trying to get ahead for summer. You got any other new brews that you're looking at in the near future that people need to be keep an eye out for?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we're doing the nice thing about the size of system we have, which is one barrel pretty small, is we're able to do a lot of new beers, which what I really enjoy, building recipes and trying new ingredients and things like that. We just did a brand new West Coast style IPA last week, so look for that in 2 weeks. Let's see what else. I got a new coconut brown coming out. We're getting into our barrel aging program now. So I did a black barley wine that will be barrel aged. So we got barrels coming next week. Looking forward to that. Unfortunately, it'll be a while before we get the sample.
What type of barrel are you using?
So we're using barrels from, do you remember Highmark Distillery off Scout Lake in Sterling?
Yes.
So they moved to Reno. So Felicia's sending us up some barrels that they did 100% sweet corn single malt bourbon with. Yeah, we're looking forward to seeing what that does to our black barley wine.
That sounds like it's going to be pretty interesting. Are you going to do any special packaging, or is it just going to be on draft?
I would like to, at that point, we're talking a year from the release, right? At least at that point, yeah, I hope to be able to, offer some bottles of that, wax dipped, and so people can get to take it home. It'll be on the tap here too, in the tap room.
What else you've got coming up? I mean, you mentioned you're still brewing on a one barrel system, which God love you. That's a lot of work. What about your future plans? You mentioned you're looking at putting in a stage. What about expansion plans for the brewery?
For the brewery itself, it seems like every day we have a new plan. We do need to expand our brewing capacity, whether that's trying to retrofit something into the existing building, or adding on to the existing building, or even adding a standalone building on its own on our property. Those plans all kind of interchange, priority wise, depending on the week. But I don't have a definitive answer for you. I know we're still looking at it, probably a year or two out from any kind of expansion, but definitely our top priority we're going to be working towards.
And like I said, brewing one barrel at a time, that's a lot of work.
It's probably two full-time jobs to keep up with the demand.
Yeah. So summer, got any plans to change your hours? Any change in your operation? I know you guys have a food truck that's pretty much there constantly. Is that the plan to continue through the summer, or is it going to be moving around with other ones coming in?
Our summer vision is Travis at Backwoods Burgers here, he's going to be our primary truck. I don't know if we'll bring anybody else in or not. He's been able to keep up pretty good. He's got a phenomenal menu. He's a great chef. Lucky to have a food truck dedicated to only us. So we'll probably see, mostly just Travis throughout the summer. We are going to be building a better, a more permanent beer garden outside. It'll go with the new stage and everything like that. We'll be putting in some new fire pits, kind of permanent gas-fed fire pits. So that'll be exciting. We've got a couple concerts coming up. I think the first one's going to be in July. If we're able to get the stage done before then, we might even, you know, try and get one in June. But it's kind of a tall order with everything we got going on right now, trying to manage. But definitely we're going to do a handful of concerts this year, summer, fall, weather permitting. And then as far as hours, we're not bound to the 9 o'clock closing. We're going to change our summer hours to 9 o'clock. But, you know, as long as we're busy, we're busy.
Still planning to be the 4 days a week, though.
You know, and that's if we can keep up, to be honest with you. I mean, we might even have to shave off a day, you know, to keep up. We'll see. We've, you know, streamlined a lot of our operating procedures here. So hopefully we can hang on with the 4 days a week.
You're back to that one barrel bottleneck.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yeah. Do you think you're going to make it to the beer festival in August, the Rotary Festival in Soldotna?
Fortunately not, Bill. We do the one, you know, the Frozen River Fest, mm-hmm. and that's for now probably the only one that we're going to be able to attend. You know, the timing, you being February with the Frozen River Fest, works out really well.
Yeah.
But that Peninsula Beer Fest, I think it's in August, is that right?
Yeah, I think it's the first weekend in August, yeah.
That's kind of like peak, you know, peak summertime so I don't think we'll be able to attend that. We have to brew basically, you know, 4 additional times to attend an event like that, so someday.
Well, cool. That all sounds great. Jake, anything else going on that you want to tell everybody about?
Oh, let's see. I think I covered it, Bill. Nothing I can think of.
Okay. Our listeners out there, if you don't already like Knaptown on Facebook, you should. Make sure you stay abreast of all the doings and events and things like that. It's great to have you guys out there in Sterling, close to where I live. Like I said, I ran over there on Sunday in between the Mariners doubleheader and had a beer. So it was nice to have a place quite so close.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Glad we can accommodate you, though.
Right. Well, again, thanks a lot, Jake. I appreciate you taking time out of your busy brew day to talk with us.
Yes, sir. Appreciate it, Bill, as always. And it's a pleasure.
All righty. This is Drinking on the Last Frontier, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. We'll be right back with our next segment.
With an increase in measles cases in the lower 48, now is a great time to make sure your family is up to date on protection against measles. Measles can be prevented with the MMR vaccine, and every child 1 year or older is eligible. Learn how to check your family immunization records and find locations to get vaccinated at vaccinate.alaska.gov. This message brought to you by the Alaska Department of Health.
We're going to talk about the science of brewing with a focus on the water. The chemistry of the water used in the brewing of beer has had a long and significant impact on the quality of beer, even though the exact mechanisms and science behind it weren't really understood until the end of the 19th century. Prior to that time, brewers learned by trial and error which were the best brews that could be produced using their local water supply. Towns that became famous brewing centers usually did so due to the special qualities of their local water. We're all familiar with hard and soft water, especially here on the peninsula. When rain falls, it's usually soft, meaning it has nothing dissolved in it. When it hits the ground, it comes in contact with rocks and minerals, some of which, usually calcium and magnesium, dissolve into it. The ions from these minerals determine whether the water stays soft or becomes hard. Hardness can also be temporary or permanent. Temporary hard water contains hydrogen carbonate ions. If the water is boiled, these break down into carbonate ions and react with the dissolved calcium and magnesium to form solid precipitates like limescale. Permanently hard water contains dissolved sulfate rather than carbonate ions, and these don't behave the same, so the water stays hard even when it is boiled. This difference in temporary and permanent hardness has big implications for different beer styles. Ever wonder why London became famous for its brown ales and porters? The water in London has lots of calcium ions and plenty of temporary hardness, which is the perfect water profile to brew ales made from dark, highly roasted malts. Compare that water profile to the water used to brew beer such as Pilsner Urquell in the Czech Republic. To brew a Pilsner with its clean malt flavor and crisp hop notes, the ideal kind of brewing water is very soft, with almost no minerals dissolved in it. The water supply for the brewery in Pilsen just happens to be amazingly soft, perfect for producing its namesake beers. What if you want to brew a hoppy pale ale? If you're making a strong pale ale, ideally you want a high concentration of calcium ions. This reduces haze and helps the beer clarify better and minimizes the extract of colored material, all of which emphasizes and accentuates a bright, pale, hoppy beer. A good level of bicarbonate is also desirable, as this helps control pH and get more out of the hops. You want low levels of sodium, potassium, and chloride. Sodium and potassium both contribute saltiness, whereas sodium and chloride both give a fuller, more mellow palate, which is fine for a porter or stout, but not dry, zippy pale ale. Instead, you want a high level of sulfate, which gives a drier flavor and works well with the hops to enhance their bitterness. The water profile I've just outlined describes perfectly the water from deep wells in the town whose name has become synonymous with India pale ales, Burton-upon-Trent. The influence of water chemistry on beer was finally grasped in the last half of the 19th century as part of the scientific revolution that made brewing less of an art and more of a science, which also made the establishment of huge industrial breweries possible. Today, thanks to this understanding, brewers can easily adjust the chemistry of their brewing water to exactly match the water from these historic brewing towns. If a brewer wants to make an IPA today, he will simply add the correct amount of a powder known as Burton salts, and his water will have the sulfate levels to match that city's famous wells. If tomorrow he wants to brew a Pilsner, then he will ensure his water is as clean and soft as Pilsen's. Coming to understand water chemistry was one of the key strides in the science of brewing and has made it possible for American craft brewers to replicate classic beer styles from all over the world. Up next, we'll have our final segment on this month's beer style. This is Drinking on the Last Frontier, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna.
May 4th is Neighbor Day at the Kenai Peninsula Food Bank. The food bank is seeking volunteers and donations to help neighbors in need. Donations of food, time, and funds are needed, and help in spreading the word. More information can be found at kpfoodbank.org or by calling 907-416-7619.
In this month's beer style segment, I'd like to depart from our usual format, which is talking about popular beer styles and where you can find local examples of them. Instead, I'd like to discuss a historical British beer style called Burton Ale. Once a hugely popular style, today it's all but extinct, and the few commercial examples still brewed do not even refer to themselves by that name. However, it's a style that I've personally brewed and found to be truly worthy of a revival. So let's talk about Burton Ales. Burton Ale was a rich, strong, dark amber ale, probably up to as much as 11% alcohol by volume, which predated and then later coexisted with the pale ales and India pale ales for which Burton-on-Trent in the United Kingdom, also known as simply Burton, became famous. It fits squarely into the category of brown beers, which were the most common brews in Britain, certainly up until the rise of porters in the 18th century. There's evidence that the abbots of the monasteries in Burton were brewing in the 13th century. This had ceased by Henry VIII's dissolution of the monasteries in the 16th century, but by this time small commercial brewers were making ale in the town. In those days, ale was produced in its original sense in that it was not brewed with hops. These came to Burton later, probably in the 16th century. Burton Ale was brewed by collecting the first and richest wort and fermenting it separately to make strong ale. The grain would then be remashed with hot water two or more times, and the dilute worts collected and used to make table and small beers. Burton Ale would have been brewed from malt paler than the brown, high-dried malt used for porter, but one that was still much darker than the modern pale ale malts. By the 18th century, it was still only brewed on a relatively small scale compared to London Porter. but Burton must have obtained a solid reputation by then, for there was a small export trade to London and Hull after the river was opened to shipping with the 1699 Trent Navigation Act. In the last quarter of the 18th century, with the opening of several canals, Burton Ale was able to also reach Manchester and Liverpool by barge. One result of this improved accessibility to deep-sea ports was that Burton Ale was regularly exported to the Baltic countries, notably Russia. Here it apparently held its own against the strong imperial stouts, which were being exported from London to the Russian court. Such trade came to an end with the Napoleonic Wars as a result of blockades and embargoes. The Burton brewers saw India as an alternative export destination, developed a method for producing paler malt, and began to brew India Pale Ale. From then on, breweries in Burton saw phenomenal growth, outpacing even the great London brewers. In particular, Bass became the world's largest brewing company by 1876. So in a sense, Burton Ale was the direct ancestor of today's hugely popular IPAs. At the height of their popularity in mid-19th century Britain, Burton Ales were darker and slightly sweeter, but just as highly hopped as the India Pale Ales being produced by the same breweries. Burton Ales also spent several months in wooden barrels, allowing their flavors to blend and mellow. These ales would have been quite strong by today's standards, with an alcohol volume routinely greater than 7% and sometimes as high as 11%. However, the tastes of the public are always changing. By the start of the 20th century, the popularity of Burton Ales, indeed all dark beers in Britain, had begun a long, slow decline. This decline was accelerated by the limitations imposed on the British brewing industry by two world wars, which greatly reduced the alcoholic strength of the beers on offer, especially strong dark brews like Burton Ales. Still, they remained popular enough that in World War II, RAF pilots would refer to their fallen comrades by the phrase, "He's gone for a Burton," preferring to think of them as having stepped out for a drink rather than having been killed. After the war, the growing popularity of pale ales sounded the death knell for commercially produced Burton Ales. By the end of the 1960s, there were no beers being brewed that called themselves Burton Ales, though a few hardy survivors remained under different titles. Interestingly, one of the longest surviving Burton Ales was actually brewed in the U.S. Ballantine Burton Ale was first brewed in Newark in the 1930s and aged for up to 20 years in American oak. Designated a special brew, the beer was given as a gift to prestigious friends of the brewery, including the White House. The beer was described as sweet, strong, yet balanced by a robust hoppiness. Today, if you're looking for a commercial example of a Burton Ale, there are still a few to choose from, if you can find them. Young's Winter Warmer, which was actually called Young's Burton until 1971, is such a survivor. It's a ruby brown classic, well-rounded, mellow, old oak dark, 5% alcohol by volume, with a brown, fruity sugar tang offset by a hint of bitter undercurrent. Unfortunately, to taste it, you'll probably have to visit London. During the 3 years I lived there, it was certainly one of my favorites. Others in the style are Marston's Old Roger Ale or Theakston's Old Peculiar. Both are excellent, but difficult to find outside Britain, as is the beer most true to the style, London-based brewer Fuller's 1845, a bottle-conditioned beer first produced in 1995 to celebrate the company's 105th anniversary, using an actual recipe from a century and a half ago. The beer is strong, dark, slightly sweet, and matured for 100 days before bottling. Among breweries here in Alaska, Bleeding Heart Brewery in Palmer and Magnetic North Brewing Company of Anchorage have recently collaborated on a Burton Ale. A small portion was released in March, but the majority of it is being barrel-aged by both breweries for a release later this year. Well, that's it for this month's show. I hope you've enjoyed it. For our final thought, we again turn to that great American philosopher, W.C. Fields, who said, quote, "Beer may not solve your problems, but neither will water or milk." Until next time, cheers.